Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a sculptor and her husband. Her husband, Michael Harding, is a writer and actor, Irish Times columnist and author of the recent memoir, Staring at Lakes. In his writings, he often refers to his wife, not by name, but as his beloved. We've heard a lot about her from Michael's point of view, so this morning I'm particularly pleased to welcome her to studio. Michael's beloved is Cathy Carman. Cathy is an accomplished sculptor whose work can be seen right across this country, here in Dublin at the St. Killian German School, at the Blasket Island Interpretive Centre in Dunquinan, County Kerry, and in her own native Port Leisha. She's just completed a body of work for exhibition and also is part of a group show in the Derry City of Culture. You're both very welcome to studio. Where did you meet the pair of you?
Well, we met originally in Annamacarrig, the Tyrone Guthrie Centre. I was a priest at the time and I was on the way out. I was at the door of the priesthood, if you like, and I had finished my book about it. So I went off to Annamacarrig to kind of do the final draft for a publisher. And I found it very intimidating because there was a kind of a posh element to everything that intimidated me. There's nothing wrong with being posh, but like there was a huge amount of successful people sitting around the table and I was kind of very intimidated. And one day this woman came in, young woman, about 30, 29, 28 years of age, very beautiful, very dark-haired, and she looked at me, and she just looked at me. And nobody had looked at me for a long time. They used to step over me. And I thought, Jesus, I might have a chance in just communicating with her, you know? So we had the dinner, and I'm watching her all the time. And the big poets are talking about the last time they met in a, you know, restaurant in Tokyo or haven't seen you since Warsaw or something. And all big published writers and famous people. And that night I'm in the pub and there's a few of the artists there and I'm drinking on my own, looking over and I'm watching her. And then we go back to Tyrone Guthrie Centre and we're having another little glass of Blackbush whiskey or something. Mm-hmm. And I finally had worked up courage to go over to her. And I wandered over to her and I said, I think I love you.
Did you think about that before you said it to her, by the way?
I did, yeah. And she said, you're drunk.
Were you?
And I knew I was, of course, yeah. But it was a kind of a way of saying, I'd love to talk to you. Do you know what I mean? It was a kind of a fun way of saying, how are you doing? I think I knew immediately that we connected. And I can't explain it, but definitely I had that intensity on the first time I met her. And that was in 1984. About the middle of August.
Do you remember those moments? First of all, when was the first moment you noticed he was looking at you in Annamacarrig?
I do remember because we were at the big table and I remember being at one side and looking down and he had this habit of just looking at everybody, you know, and I'm saying, why is he just looking at everybody? You know, why isn't he talking, you know? Yeah. And to discover later that he never stops talking. But anyway, he was probably feeling a bit out of his depth in the place, and so was I, sure. It was my first time there. Again, you would feel that you're surrounded by the whole of the successful world. But I had just finished my first one-person show. I had been in the project, and people knew me from that. If I hadn't done that, I was absolutely a nobody. It just gave me one little plus at the table. I just remember him looking all the time, just kind of contemplating on people, something I had the habit of doing, rather than speaking, feeling intimidated every time. You know, I would sit down with people I felt that were intellectually above me. I would just sit and stare and listen.
And listen.
Which I would enjoy.
Now, when he came up to you and said, I think I love you, what did you think?
What did I think? Well, I couldn't say on air what I thought, but I didn't take it seriously for sure.
Now, Legion from Cavan, you know, coming up, chatting you up, oh, I think I love you.
I think it's a very romantic thing, though,
yeah,
for you to have done. Because even if you'd had drink taken, which you had, you knew what you were doing.
I did, yeah. We spent the night together.
Oh, that's a bit naughty.
Well, that can happen sometimes, you know.
But I read your book. Nothing happened that night.
You're getting into the forensic detail of being inside the bedroom, what might happen. Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
We sat there gazing at the moon.
But that's romantic.
And I do still remember that. I do still remember the light of the moon making the roof silver outside in the courtyard, in the farmyard, in Annamacarrig, and lying there and knowing wow, my life has changed.
Do you remember that as well?
No, I remember the next morning. The morning after.
He looks at her.
We decided to go for a walk. And I remember him in the kitchen peeling an orange and wrapping it in a tissue and taking it. And I was saying, I'd never do that, you know? Something peculiar to him, which he always does, peel an orange, take it with him somewhere and eat it. So we walked to the end of the avenue and sat on a bench looking back up at the lake. And it was just beautiful. The sun was shining. And I thought, here you are. I'm getting on really well with this person. He's really nice. And of course, there's no future in it. I thought, oh, sure, what the heck? Isn't this lovely?
At what stage did you realise he was a priest still?
Oh, everybody had told me.
They warned her off. Do you see your man over there? Watch out for him. He's an old priest. But I was on my way out. Do you know what I mean? And I had the book finished, which was called Priest. And in fact, and I've only remembered this now, I showed that book. I gave that book to Kathy, the manuscript, on that occasion. Mm-hmm. That's how much I trusted her from day one. I said, would you read a manuscript for me?
Oh.
Like, I hadn't shown it to anybody else in the house.
So you really
I did. I felt at home with her as a person. And so I still do. Yeah. I still do, you know. I think relationship, we're 30 years together and relationships, you know, are not all perfect. You know, it's like, you know, there's things go wrong and you don't succeed. Like, nobody's perfect. I wasn't very successful as a lover, as a seducer or as a husband. But you do good enough. But certainly I get a sense of transformation that I think is what love is about. That love changes you. Do you know what I mean? Like that your partner or whoever you love, in some sense, changes you. You become different when their light shines on you.
That's a lovely way of putting it. I hadn't thought about it like that, actually.
I think that's it.
And then you both left the house at that time, didn't you? Well, you went your separate ways, really.
We went separate ways, yeah. I mean, I had to focus on the fact that I was disengaging from the priesthood and get on with my life as a writer. So there was a kind of a gap for about a year, maybe a year and a half. And then finally I left my curacy in Derry Lynn and I headed for Dublin on a bicycle. I liked the idea of going off on a bike. So I left Cavan and went as far as Lavie Strand and then I got the bus to Dublin.
I was just going to say, I was very impressed, Derry Lynn, Dublin.
So it was the autumn of 85 then that we spent in Dublin in a kind of the beginning of a courtship.
But now, had you thought about her when you left Anna McCarrick and you went your separate ways?
Yeah, we met, there was twice she came down. Mm. But there was one time then that she was down. It was the following August. It was 12 months from Anna McCarrick. And I remember leaving her to the bus in Enniskillen and we kissed, just like a peck on the cheek or a peck on the lips. And the peck on the lips, you thought, is the difference between day and night. Mm. And I thought, this is it. So I went back to my little presbytery, my little priest's house and my little empty fire grate. And I realised, I felt the sense of love coming into my life and I couldn't bear not connecting with her. And I tried her phone a few times and I couldn't get her all over the weekend because she'd been away she was working on a sculpture, a big wooden piece up in Wicklow, I think. Wasn't that right? And you'd been away and then she came back to Dublin and I got her on the phone on Monday morning and this is genuine. I you know, once I heard her voice on the phone, I said, I was thinking of going away somewhere. Like, would you be interested maybe in coming to Paris? And she said, what about Berlin?
Did you?
Yeah, something like that. I remember he suggested somewhere and I wanted somewhere different, you know. And I don't know why we went to Italy then, if that was the case.
I think it was a compromise.
You said Berlin and I said Rome.
Yeah, it was like somebody says, I'll have the pizza. And then she says, well, what about the salad, the Caesar salad? And so you're compromising, you two just have a steak.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But that year when you left Anna McCarrick and you hadn't seen him much, did you miss him? Did you think he could be right for you?
I did, I suppose, but I didn't see it as being possible. I wasn't, you know, wasting time worrying about it.
Because did you think he might never stop being a priest?
He was still a priest, so I wasn't going there. I wasn't going to start this kind of carry on, you know. I wouldn't be interested in it.
But you still dropped into him twice.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're young, you're going around the country, you want to go places, you want to see, you want to enjoy. I really enjoy Michael's company all the time. And he was, never stops talking, so you know, he did all the peddling and ideas and he introduced me to Blackbush whiskey, which was very nice. So, It was always very intense and enjoyable and stimulating. And he's well-read, whereas I'd be on the verges of well-read, you know.
Yeah, you see, I'd say the opposite, because I knew nothing about art or the art world. And the art world in Dublin was a whole big, real world. And there were people in it who Cathy was close to and friends with. And it was a world that I kind of would step into with trepidation. I was only the gobdaw from Cavan. You know, I was nothing. I hadn't published anything. And yet this was a woman that everybody around Temple Bar knew. Yeah, she had an exhibition and project last year. She had this, she had that. And so she introduced me to a world of kind of professional artists. And in a sense, the company of people who are outside the normal bourgeois world. One of the problems you get trapped in is in conventional jobs. And people disapprove of anything is other than that. And in a sense, the artist has to be like a revolutionary. They have to be like a serious, radical critic of society. And that leaves them somewhat on the edge of society, somewhat in their own community, right? Which is a necessary place to be. And I wouldn't have had the confidence, I would say, to be a writer had I not met Cathy. This was like, you could say, a sly, easy way, you know, get in with a good artist and it will give you the confidence to be that.
Yourself, in other words.
To let go of all the old bourgeois things like your mother looking at you sadly and saying, and what are you doing now? You know.
But you got married about 20 years ago, didn't you, Cathy?
Yes.
Was it important for you both to marry each other? Like, did that make a difference?
It did, yes. You reach a point where you're sharing your life and your ideas and all. But have you gone as far as you can go as partners? Do you want to go further? And if you do go further, what does that involve? And we thought about it and we discussed it. And like, I already had a son, Simon, from my first marriage. And it would have been important to me, I think, when I look back on it, you know. There was something about it. I wanted it to work right and be good. And we decided to go for it. And it was lovely.
And yet, in another way, it all happened accidentally.
He's got his arms outstretched now. Just want to explain this to the listeners. Go.
Cathy used to have a studio in Temple Bar, where Temple Bar galleries are now, is where she worked. And all that Temple Bar area was empty. There was maybe one or two coffee shops in it. And it was full of artists in places. But at some stage, because of the new Temple Bar, she was going to move out of her studio. And at that stage, we said, maybe we should kind of risk living together kind of more fully than we've been. Because up until then, we always said, as long as I treat you primarily as the artist, and that's the relationship, this works. And she'd say, as long as I treat you as the writer, that we were dealing as two artists. With an independence, you know. We didn't want, again, the bourgeois idea of marriage. And then we thought, well, let's risk living together. And Cathy had a relation, I forget who it was, you know, your woman.
Zita McGrath. She's an art teacher.
She says, I have an aunt who has a house in a place called Keijoo, but I think it's kind of in a remote area. And I said to myself, that's not a remote area. That's near Glengevlin. That's the centre of the world. That's, you know, near Arigna, where there's beautiful flute music. This is like the best place you could go. So we decided to, for the first time, really formally, jointly rent a place together. That led to, well, why don't we have a house party? And then we were really looking at each other and said, this is it, isn't it? Why don't we get married? And that's the way it happened. And then we went and got married in Skehana in East Galway. And drove all the guests up to Keijoo and had the party there.
And so who sat up first at that moment? Should we may as well get married?
I think it was both of us together.
Yeah, I think
it was. In the eyes. Yeah. I mean, it was like hanging around the kitchen for about 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
And you'd say, I know what you're thinking.
Yeah.
You know, we couldn't afford anything. We were both absolute paupers. So our wedding was a friend, a beautiful friend of Cathy, Gabby Dowling. She made beautiful food for it. Mary McPartlin, a friend of mine, did the music for it.
But you loved it, I'd say.
Oh, it went on. Mary McPartlin sang all night. And even in the morning, there was still, I think, 13 litres of wine left.
That's right. That was
kind of a miracle.
Mm. loving you a long time. Down all the years, down all the days. And I've cried for all your troubles, smiled at your funny little ways.
Shane McGann wrote that beautiful song, Rainy Night and So, sung really beautifully as well by your friend Mary McPartlin and her album there, The Holland Handkerchief. Does her singing that song bring you back to the day?
Absolutely. She sang in the church and then in the house that evening. It was remarkable. It was beautiful because her voice is pure. It's beautiful. Yeah,
it's a beautiful voice. Where did you grow up?
Portlaoise.
Portlaoise.
I really should be known as Catherine Byrne, but my life changed my name. And I was born in the Dublin Road, opposite the prison. We had a shop. Went to school there.
Nuns?
No. Presentation Nuns. Run by Mother Columba from Kerry. After that, I realised people from Kerry are different. They make the world work, you know. Take what they have and make it work, you know. And she was a great driving force to get us all out in the world, either get a job, get to college, free education and just come in.
They were great drivers, though, when you got drivers, people like that. And you had another very good teacher, didn't you, then, in the VEC? Was it Mary Russell?
Mary Russell, our teacher. She was this woman, came from Dublin. She was young. She was vibrant. Gosh, she lit the town up. And she happened to move in beside where we were living. She had a flat. And Mary came into the shop and the man was talking to her. And she said, oh, I have this daughter. She's always drawn and danky, danky, danky. And Mary, 3 days later, comes in and said, I'm going to do classes for kids who have no opportunities to do it. And it'll be a couple of afternoons after school in the VEC. And there she did. And it was brilliant. And she was total positive encouragement. Something I'd never experienced before because art wasn't looked on as a possibility in life, you know.
So she almost made you feel it could be something you could do.
She told me. I had done this painting and I called it The Drovers. It was based on, is it a Patrick Cullen poem? Mm. Anyway, it was all I knew was the old lads hanging around with sticks and hats and, you know, vaguely looked like my father. I had three different versions standing by and called him The Drover. And she said, you know, that's good, you know, that's... You've got what it takes. You should look at going to college. And I was like, maybe it's possible.
And didn't you win a competition as well around the time of what was then the Intercert, the Juniors, the Clark's shoes? Tell me about that.
Children are always doing competitions and, you know, colouring in pictures or answering this. And Clark's had a competition. You either filled in a form or you designed a pair of shoes. And I said, designed a pair of shoes. And I designed these shoes. And when I look back, they were actually quite good, you know, and it had preempted design trends that were coming, like cloggy type shoes with designs and all the rest. And I'd added some drapery to it that looked almost like this top on me, you know, scalloped up and down. And my mum was working away, getting the dinner and minding the shop at the same time. The phone rings and this Clark's. So they told her they wanted to give me the prize. Quite a substantial prize. It was like thousands or £2,000. And a complete outfit.
Wow, that was
or instead of the money, you could go to Paris to Pierre Balmain's spring collection. So that was a no-no. As far as I was concerned, from Portlaoise to Paris, no. I want the money. I'm going to college. It was great.
Did you go to NCAD?
I did, yeah.
And at what stage in your life did you think, I can do this? I can be a sculptor?
Well, you discover that. And that's the thing about college, to do what they call a foundation course, and that allows you to explore all different medias, and you find yourself not wanting to do the painting. It's not just you want to be making things. And so at the time I was actually doing this constructivist type things with light and heat and plastic, and so they were more like installations rather than sculptures. You know, they were quite grotesque really, but they were fun, and they were a bit anti-establishment. I was really trying to just, you know, annoy the powers that be at the time, you know.
You said, Michael, haven't you, that you see what Cathy does as a vocation, not a career as such, that it is a vocation.
Yeah, I remember one time very early on, I think it was about 1987, she had a show in the Grafton Gallery. I think Kieran McGonigal was the guy doing it. And I remember going in to meet her just before the preview thing, you know, and she had these bronze figures and they were like human figures, but they were like almost kind of primitive and extreme in their emotional expression. And I said to her, I don't think she had titles on some of them. And I said, well, what's the title of it? And she said, I don't know. I wouldn't know. You put, you know, what do you think yourself? And I said, but what's it about? And she said, I think that, you know, for me, she said, art is always mysterious, or that it doesn't allow you in the beginning. And I thought that is like a sense of presence. There was a George Steiner wrote a book called Real Presence about art. And I thought this is the clearest example of what Steiner talks about in art, that art is a kind of a presence, and it's not easy available. You have to work to engage with it, to find out what it's really saying to you. Mm. I thought that about the work I was looking at in the Grafton Gallery, but I thought it about the woman I was talking to. And I think that sums up to me how Cathy's personality is almost intrinsic to the work.
To her work. You had your son very young, which I think is a real tribute to you, that you managed to stay even working as an artist and bring up a young son. Was that challenging, to use a terrible word, at the time?
Yeah, I think people think things like that are challenging, but they are. But I had huge support. I come from a large family. Like, my sister Frances just about reared Simon as much as I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, another sister, Melik, she would be the same, Carol. Margaret would always be sending you up stuff. You never, like, felt you were on your own.
It's a good thing about a big family.
I think so. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But we're going to take a piece of music that you love, Cathy, which is the Nancy Griffith.
I like it because it just makes me laugh. I think it's just a howl. And I find sometimes when you're working, you're hammering away and banging. And what are you at? Why is your obsession doing this kind of thing? You're wrecking your body and your ears and drums and everything. And I find if I go anywhere, I even found myself, we were away there last week in Portugal, and there I am in the hardware shop looking for something interesting to hammer with, you know. And they're looking at me, what is this tourist doing in here?
Looking for a hammer. Does she want to kill her husband?
It wasn't a hammer. I got a brilliant big sieve.
Yeah. It's got a handle here. Yeah.
I just say that it's another part of where I find Cathy so intrinsically. The artist and the person is the one thing that, you know, she's the man about the house. Do you know what I mean? If builders come to build a shed, it's her to talk to, not me. And they're there. She's talking technical stuff to them about plaster and walls or something because she has a beautiful compulsion of a tradesperson or a craft person or an artist. She has an obsession, not just with the kind of finished work, but the process. So she's endlessly in hardware shops. She wears me out. I get totally crazy. You're on holidays and she ends up in a hardware shop looking at chisels or something.
And then Lidl's came to Ireland, you know, and I had Lidlitis for at least 2 years, you know.
She was in bed last night. We were in bed last night.
Yeah.
And like, there's that moment where you know it's about gone asleep. The last sort of good night, I'll see you in the morning. And I know she's still awake and she says, what was it? There's a hedge cutter in Lidl's this week on Thursday. I said, great. I had something to dream about.
And that will take Nancy Griffith's version of If I Had a Hammer.
Okay.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening, all over this land, I'd a hammer out danger, I'd a hammer out a warning, I'd a hammer out the love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land.
Nancy Griffith there, your choice, If I Had a Hammer. I think it should be your anthem. It obviously suits her. What's it like working together? I mean, you're both artists, writer, sculptor. Yeah. Do you fight?
Yeah, of course we do. But no, actually, we don't fight like people, you know, fight like negatively or argue.
Yeah.
But there are times where I'd say Cathy gets totally browned off at me. And I never get browned off at her because she's beautiful. But but what we have done, I think, in her life, like, she has her own studio. Great. And it's a beautiful space. And sometimes Cathy would go off somewhere, like to Warsaw for a month and do stuff. Sometimes I'd go off to maybe do writer in residence or something. So we get breaks from each other.
Yeah.
You know, we respect each other's individuality.
It's everybody probably having does. Your own space is good, is it, Cathy?
It's very good.
Yeah.
But getting back to the arguing, you know, the one thing Michael taught me about, if you're having a disagreement, spit it out, discuss it, you know, because I was terrible for internalizing stuff and not verbalizing it out. And the other person is trying to figure out, well, what's wrong with you today? Why are you this way or that way? And when you explain it then, of course, it's simpler. But to be this blockage sometimes in me that I wouldn't be able to. And he taught me, if you let go, it's amazing what it does for you.
It's very good advice, actually. I think women tend to do that. We kind of bottle up and get annoyed about something. Don't say what we're annoyed about.
I think men do
and
it too.
And it builds up. It builds up.
I think men do it and they do it in violence, you know. Like, I mean, you don't have to shoot people or blow up people. You can actually talk to them. That's the bottom line in war versus peace. But it's a bottom line in relationship as well. You don't have to explode. You can begin to say how you feel. And if you feel that the other person will allow you to say how you feel, no matter what it is, then you have a space. And then you can begin to understand the other person. And then you realise it's only about negotiation. You know, if you want to use the dishwasher in that fashion, do it.
He has a thing about the dishwasher.
And then I'll use it in my way.
Yeah. Does he still have a thing about that dishwasher? About how you pack it, isn't it?
Don't go there.
What's your version of the dishwasher?
Neatly packed. The spoons in one section, the knives in another. So easy then. You can just clump them all together when you're taking them out and put it away. When it's all in disarray, it takes forever to empty it.
And does he put it in disarray?
I do,
He puts it in disarray. He puts a few things in and then puts it on. And you go in and you find stuff in the sink and on the shelf, the empty cups and all that. And
I'm not even going to defend myself. I'm going to give way.
But in the way that Kathy, you know, there was that moment, maybe the teacher in VEC and stuff that gave you a feeling you could be a sculptor. When did you think you could write?
I published poems in the Reader's Digest when I was 11. And I had a poem on a junior children's programme on RTE that Terry Prone used to do when I was about 13, and I was so thrilled. And then when I was 16, I got poems into the Irish Press, New Irish Writing. So I really always wanted to be a writer. And I got my uncle to give me a typewriter when I was about 15. And I learned with all my 8 fingers. And to me, to be a writer was the only thing I wanted to do.
But were you quite a confident boy then?
Not really. Like, I wasn't confident about playing football, about swimming. You know, I was a sad little inhibited, gangly fella. You know, he'd be afraid to take off his trousers in a swimming pool and would never socialise very well. And I didn't get on very well with people at that level. But I was confident as a writer. I associated it from the very beginning with a kind of spiritual journey. You know, I feel I became a priest because I was a writer. I always wanted to be a storyteller. And I always was a storyteller. Even as a child, it's how I'd get accepted. I wasn't an alpha male, but I had my own quiet confidence. I prayed. I used to go into the church and pray. I loved the Virgin Mary. I loved May. Mary, we crown thee with. I loved all that, and I still do. I mean, when I got involved in Buddhism, and you'd be there in a Buddhist centre putting flowers on the altar to the goddess, and you'd say, sure, I was reared with this, you know.
No,
so I've always loved that side of the world, the kind of prayer, the prayer side of the world.
But when you became a priest, did you think about, you know, celibacy and giving up all of that and the potential for love, a love maybe of a woman?
Yeah, I know this is hard to explain. It wasn't like that in the 70s. It just wasn't. It was a different planet before John Paul II was Pope. It was a different planet. The people that you admired were the revolutionary guys, Jesuits in the government in Nicaragua. To be a priest was to be a revolutionary, and you would always have a woman at your side. And it was the perfect idea if you were a writer to end up as a revolutionary in Nicaragua or Recife or somewhere on the barrios, writing your great stories or poems like Pablo Neruda and maybe a beautiful woman at your side. That was all. That was the vision. We thought in the 70s that celibacy would end like next Tuesday because there was no canon law. It really was the way. And there was an enormous kind of intellectual fascism that rewrote history from 1981 onwards. And we're only now beginning to see that thaw. But it will thaw.
But then the reality of not being a Nicaraguan rebel and being a curate in Derry Lynn.
Well, I declared my position before I was ordained. I wasn't going to stay. I absolutely made it publicly clear that once the the Pope restored canon law and the old-fashioned system, that it wasn't what we signed up to, that I really should leave. And I stayed for 4 years because I got 4 years education in the seminary. So I think I did an honourable thing by enduring it for 4 years and then wrote my letter and to the bishop and said, as I told you, this clerical thing would not suit me, so I have to leave.
Did the experience, though, stand to you? I mean, do you look back on it and regret it?
It was such an enriched blessing. It was a privilege. I didn't deserve it. I can't believe that I was lucky enough. You know, a lot of guys wanted to be priests and never became priests, and so they never took the risk. Well, I took the risk, and the privilege of being close to people and people sharing their lives with you in the priesthood, like, you know, through particularly old people. It's always old people, and old people are beautiful. And the amount of wisdom that I got from old grannies up the hills in West Cavan and in Derry Lynn was, it does me for life. So I feel very privileged, yeah, to have been a priest.
Yeah, and you've some lovely anecdotes about those women and places like Cavan.
Yeah, no.
Also, it was interesting, though, you were saying when you'd be called, I suppose, to funerals, the number of times you had to try and they'd see the priest, you coming, and you were there to reassure them.
I felt very bad about that. And I wrote that in the book because I felt I don't have faith like the people around me have faith. And so I felt that a pressure.
You're a priest at a dark time as well, though, in the north.
You know, there's a guy shot on a bus outside, you know, the school just across from where my house was, and it brought you close into that world. The wonderful thing is not actually recalling it. The wonderful thing is recalling the beautiful times. You know, Fermanagh was a beautiful place. I had a little boat, a rowboat on the Erne, and it is a beautiful place. When the peace process started, I couldn't believe how wonderful the peace was, how beautiful Fermanagh seemed, how driving from Cavan and Ballyconnell up into Fermanagh, it was a different world instead of having all these checkpoints and soldiers and fears of bombs. Mm. So I think it's lovely to build on, not a nightmare, but build on a dream. Mm. Remember the beautiful things in the past. People get a tendency to remember what's dark in their life. Mm. And even if there is dark things in their life, I think sometimes you need to kind of remember where there was beautiful things and hold on to them.
Well, it's a good way to think back on the good things. I mentioned at the beginning that in his writings, he often refers to you as his beloved. Do you mind him writing about your lives?
If you live with a writer, forget it. Nothing's private. You wouldn't have lived this long together if you were going to worry about that kind of thing. But it's not that personal. People see that it's very personal to me, like people that be close to me. How can you be saying that now? I don't even think about it.
It's always nice. He's never unkind.
Yeah, nobody's dreaming of me when they're reading it. They didn't know what I looked like. Because I don't bother travelling around with Michael that much.
But the first time you wrote about your beloved publicly, but did you make a conscious decision to do that?
No. I made a conscious decision a long time ago that I would love to write a memoir, like a creative chronicle of Midland life. I used to read Mr. Pepys, the London chronicler, who actually Steve Wickham first showed me. And I thought, you know, beyond the novel, as a literary form, the chronicle of life is a beautiful thing, and I'd love to try it. And I pitched it to Geraldine Kennedy in the Irish Times as a column for a while, and she agreed, she liked it, and then it kept going. And that's the way it is. Storytellers tell stories, and when it comes down to the wire, you only have your own story.
That's so true.
You know, like if you're just totally making something up, it's quite superfluous. When you read Joyce or you read any great writer, I mean, it is honed out of your own neurosis, anxiety, optimism, whatever. Writing is storytelling. So I don't write about Cathy Carman. I write about the beloved. And the beloved is an archetypal person. For me, in real life, that's Cathy Carman. But I don't feel I'm betraying some privacy to other people when I talk about the fact that the beloved makes me happy. Or if I also talk about sometimes getting overexcited by some young Polish girl in the centre shop in Mullingar because she has big leather boots. You know, I'm not revealing something about her. I'm revealing about me. And I'm also revealing about men. You know, and I think that what I'm doing to a great extent is trying to allow men's emotions out in ways that they don't normally, because they feel they would be compromised. You know, if women knew how vulnerable they are and how, you know, how human they are and how overexcitable they are. I find it interesting to try and let loose a kind of an inner turmoil of the male identity in all its longings and humanity.
But what's fascinating, Kathy, is watching Michael now, as I am and you are, and people are listening to him, to try and reconcile that with the man who has written so profoundly in the book about the fact that he has had such severe depression. Mm. I can't see that in him, but is that a part of him you know well?
When Michael experiences the depression, from my observation, comes on him like a wave, just washes in over him. It will go after, you know, a couple of days or whatever. And it's less severe than it has been.
Do you sense when it's coming?
Oh, you just look at his face. It changes.
Yeah, because he's a very happy face looking at him there. So what way does it go?
Well, in Port Leash, they used to say like the back of a bus. Yeah. The misery is on the face.
What I suffered was a physical collapse, and it led me into a kind of a dramatic and acute emotional distress and depression. Hmm. I realised there was a bit of that always in my life. I think there's a huge amount of men who suffer like that. Hmm. The amount of emails and letters and things I get from people saying, I've suffered like that and I never tell anybody. So that there's a way whereby everybody sometimes keeps a public face, you know? And the public face is the normal face. And then you look in the mirror and there's a voice saying, what kind of an idiot are you? That negative voice in your head destroying you. And people go around with it all the time. And that's kind of what depression is too. This negativity with yourself.
You don't realise you're depressed sometimes when you are. You think the joy that's gone out of your life has been caused by something else, like maybe your marriage isn't right or your work isn't right or something isn't right. And in fact, all that, it's not all, it's a terrible thing to be afflicted with, is you have depression. I think women get it with the menopause because you change so much and you don't know what's happening. You're waiting to come out the other end and you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, you know. And then you do, and it's just wonderful.
Did you have depression ever?
I would say, looking back, I did. You know, I just carried it because I was changing physically. I just felt I couldn't cope with it. I remember going to the doctor one day saying, I'm either going to take up drink or smoking, you know? And I took up the smoking. You know? And like, I drink, but I mean, I meant I wanted to have this kind of self-medication all the time. So I took up the old rollies and I smoked for 2 years. Nice. Enjoyed every one of them.
Yeah. Why do you think you wanted to do that? Why did you think
my body was just demanding this from me all?
Was that the menopause?
And did that make you understand more what Michael sometimes goes through?
I think so. Yeah. Mm. I kind of had empathy for it.
Yeah.
I said, that's exactly how I felt, you know, and I wasn't, as he said, voicing it.
But that was before. In other words, I would have, if there was melancholy in me, like many men, I would have hidden it over my life. I might sublimate it into religion and a kind of a nostalgia for heaven. Other men might do it in very bad ways, like in anger or so. But there's darkness, like sadness in us. It's hard to cope with mortality. It's hard to cope with death. It's hard to cope with the shortness of life. The more beautiful it is, the harder it is to cope. And that's in all of us, that little seed. And it can make us very sorrowful. And we need to acknowledge it. Mm. And I think a huge amount of depression divides into two categories. One are people who are seriously clinically depressed through life and they need medication, whatever. And it's a very special and acute form of illness. But it's a wider group, which I think I fell into all my life. And that's people who carry a sort of melancholy that comes out like a bad mood often. And can sometimes ruin relationships and sometimes ruin children's lives.
But I can see how close you are, but you're not the conventional couple. I mean, because you went to Mullingar for a while yourself. Yeah. I mean, you lived apart for a number of years.
Well, we lived apart for 5 years, even though in those 5 years, Kathy was there every weekend. She was minding the child. You know, we weren't really kind of, we were separate, but not separated. Mm. And because we had that space, we didn't separate. In other words, a lot of relationships, I think, that break up because of the nuclear family. You know, they're too much in their faces 24/7 with nothing to do. It must be crazy. And then eventually you become like Mutton Jeff. So you say, you know, do you want a cup of tea? I don't know. Do you want a cup of tea?
Our face.
Will we watch Coronation Street or EastEnders? Like that kind of neurotic. Like, do you know what I mean? Get your own life. And then the more you have within yourself, the more you bring.
It's a risky thing, though. So some couples might feel if they lived, all right, not separated, separate,
yeah,
one of you might run off.
Yeah,
well,
she might meet
an attractive guy, too. Forget the girl Svetlana. With the boots in the centre.
Svetlana in the centre.
Yeah.
Or Kathy might have a model in the studio.
Yeah.
You know, because I ask her, would she ever, you know, I keep offering myself as a naked model to her. She won't have me at all. She won't do anything with me. And then she has these young fellas in. No,
yeah.
I don't know. It's not fair. Seriously. She did put up with me for 2 years, and I don't know how she stuck it. I wouldn't have got through it without Kathy.
Did you ever worry that she'd love you less?
Ah, no, more. I'll tell you.
She's laughing.
My therapist.
Yeah, I told you.
My therapist told me.
Yeah.
I used to talk to him on Skype. He's an American therapist.
Oh, Lord.
And we used to do a Skype interview.
Okay.
And he said it would be good for both of us. The illness, because you see, it made me for the first time in my life vulnerable.
Okay.
But it also gave Kathy a new way to relate to me. Instead of having a normal human being, she had, you know, a big sick dog. So it brought out of her compassions that she didn't know were in her.
Do you remain true to your faith?
I do not know anything.
Okay.
Right? And so wherever I can wing it on a bit of prayer, and wherever I can light a candle, whether it's to the Mother of Jesus or the white, you know, Tara Buddha, I'm quite happy.
Yeah.
You pray to enrich your life now. Mm. Prayer is what makes you more an expressive artist, more and more human person. Prayer is music. Prayer is the incense off the stick. It's just a beautiful thing. And it's like this choosing of joy in your life, no matter how hard it is.
It's a nice way of thinking about it. Kathy, as we close, you're working on this new exhibition for the Derry City of Culture.
I'm part of a group show in the Gordon Gallery in the Derry City of Culture. That's opening up there, I think it's the 8th of July.
Anyone can look at it. I was looking earlier on online at Kathy Carman and see your work.
Yeah.
And Michael, you're heading to do a reading at the West Cork Literary Festival.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, July the 9th at 1 o'clock.
That's right.
And you're also reading in Donegal, the Errigal Festival.
The Errigal Festival. I'm in Belfast at some festival on the 8th of August and a few other places. I'm reading around the country on the Owl Stern at Lakes book.
Yeah.
Given the Owl readings.
Yeah, it's a really well written book. But look, and we're going to take the last piece of music, Michael, your choice, Eleanor Shanley, singing Hard Times.
Yeah. I just think, again, she has a beautiful voice from Leitrim. And before I became friends with her, and before Kathy and me became friends with her, many years ago when she sang with the Danann, and she still does sing with the Danann, excuse me, but that song, it used to be on an album when I was a child, that in our house, and it's a gospel, it's an old black gospel slavery song, Hard Times Come Again No More, and to believe even in your darkest hour that things are also good, even in the darkest hour. Not in the future, but right now, no matter how black it is, there is something beautiful that you can say, Hard Times Come Again No More. I played that song to myself on the loneliest day of my life when I was leaving Derry Lynn. I played it to myself years later when I was sick and depressed. I love it as an anthem for life, that no matter how hard things are, you can say quietly the prayer that hard times come again no more.
Oh, and she sings this absolutely
beautiful. She does, yeah.
Michael Harding, Kathy Carman, thank you both for being my guests today. On sound was Dave Gibson, my producer was Eileen Heron. Thank you very much for listening. We'll go out now with Hard Times.
Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears, for we all sup sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever.
Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.